Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I am with Dr. Mark Swedan. Dr. Swedan is the professor and vice chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Medical College. Dr. Swedan is an internationally acclaimed pediatric neurosurgeon who specializes in the management of brain tumors. Can you imagine any worse information than hearing your child has a brain tumor? Dr. Swedan is here to provide you with hope. Please stay tuned. Welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm your host, Dr. Philip Stieg, and I have as my guest Dr. Mark Swedan. Dr. Swedan is a distinguished and international pediatric neurosurgeon. He is vice chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College. It is a distinct pleasure for me to have Dr. Swedan here, and I hope and think that you will find him extremely interesting because he deals with diseases that have not only great impact on the child, but as you can imagine, there is severe impact on the family members as well. Dr. Swedan, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Stieg, and I'm glad to be here.
So, Mark, can you explain for all of us what a pediatric neurosurgeon really does?
What a pediatric neurosurgeon does is, in a simplistic sense, very similar to what an adult neurosurgeon does. There are some major differences on a day-to-day basis, on a technical basis, not entirely different from what an adult neurosurgeon would do. The major difference, in my estimation, is the pediatric neurosurgeon thinks about the disease differently. The pediatric neurosurgeon approaches every disease, whether it be something such as water on the brain or a brain tumor, from the perspective of the well-being of the child, not just today or tomorrow, but has to think 5 years, 10 years, 40 years, and even 60 years in the future to establish that that child has the best potential, not just to overcome the problem at hand for that day, for that surgical procedure, but really how to establish that child to have a normal life for the remainder of their life. And I think that is truly the essence and the difference between what a pediatric neurosurgeon does and what an adult neurosurgeon may do.
So why, your mom and dad are out there listening and they're thinking, you know, maybe my child needs a neurosurgeon. What kinds of diseases are they going to bring their child to you for?
Sure. Widely varied. Crosses many, many spectra. The disease processes start from before gestation, before the time of delivery. Those are congenital malformations that range anywhere from something that might cause water on the brain or hydrocephalus. Other congenital malformations of the brain, which are very, very common, may cause problems shortly after birth. A large segment of children that require the intervention of a pediatric neurosurgeon are brain tumors, tumors that can occur anywhere between the time of birth to the time a child is through adolescence and beyond. Epilepsy, very, very common problem in pediatrics, which is becoming more and more apparent from the standpoint of diagnostics, is a very common problem, so chronic seizure disorders. Trauma, a very common, especially seasonal, problem that the pediatric neurosurgeon might see from the standpoint of head trauma, spinal cord trauma, not uncommon at all. And other disease processes that include things such as functional disorders, like spasticity, for instance. Individuals that have a chronic disease process that might evolve into something that is functionally limiting for some reason. And a lot of the diseases and a lot of the problems that I end up seeing are actually seen first by other subspecialists. So something as an example, growth stature limitation, or a child who is not gaining in certain milestones, might see a child neurologist, might see an endocrinologist, might see an ophthalmologist, and that's the typical way that something is screened before I see that child. So it can cross many spectra and many, many different variety of diseases. Another that I left out is vascular diseases. Most individuals think, and rightfully so, that it's pretty much an adult disease with regard to vascular problems.
In that area, what kind of diseases are you talking about?
Well, the lay person, and I think individuals who think of vascular disease think of atherosclerotic disease and coronary artery disease and carotid disease and things that cause stroke. In children, it's entirely different. These are congenital variations and anomalies of the vascular system that cause things such as hemorrhage, like an arteriovenous malformation, other unique problems in children.
So by congenital, you're implying that, you know, the patient is born with that, and these basically it's lesions that can bleed into the brain.
Yeah.
Listening to that list, probably the one that for me is the most striking and compelling, and as a parent would be the one that would be the most difficult to deal with, would be if my child was told and I was told that they had a brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
Are they all serious?
Yes. Yes, they're all serious. And they all require a lot of expertise, whether or not the outcome is serious, if that's the way the word is utilized, is entirely different. And that's, again, can have a wide variety of outcomes. But they're all serious in that they're all potentially life-threatening if not handled appropriately. They're all serious in the sense that they need to be handled and managed in such a way that that child is, again, returned to a state of normalcy, if you will, and a potential to achieve normal sexual maturation, education, et cetera, et cetera. So they can go through life as a normal individual. So they're all extremely serious. That doesn't equilibrate with them all being malignant. And you're exactly right, and you're very insightful with regard to the emotional impact of the diseases that I might see on a day-to-day basis. When these parents come to the office, it is profound. It is anything beyond their expectations, and it's the last thing they ever would have thought of when Susie or Johnny woke up with a headache 3 weeks ago and had vomiting. These are very, very common presentations for children that ultimately are diagnosed with brain tumors. So when I first meet these parents and the child, my first statement is usually one of, it'll be the worst roller coaster ride of your life. It'll be an emotional, tumultuous ride. It'll have ups and downs. You'll hear good news and bad news. And there's nothing that's more true than that. And it is extremely, extremely high impact with regard to the emotional aspect of it.
Have you ever had a baby that's just too small for you to operate on?
No, not too small. It's interesting how a lot of individuals believe that because it's pediatrics and because we're dealing with children who may be on the order of days or even weeks of age, that they're too small to operate. They're not too small to operate on, but it requires an extreme amount of attention toward the standpoint of that child being smaller. And it's not so much the overall size of the child as much as other things that the child might not have the capacity to deal with independently like an adult would with regard to temperature control, for instance. The volume of circulating blood in a neonate is extremely small relative to the body, so you have to be extremely meticulous with regard to things like blood loss at the time of surgery. And it has other huge bearings with regard to the adjuvant or adjunctive techniques that we might use in neurosurgery. Examples of that would be things such as, you know, one of the large advances in neurosurgery that we've enjoyed over the past 30 years are things such as cortical mapping, which means that at the time of surgery, you can actually determine in a very millimeter basis, if you will, where important parts of the brain are located. And that requires a patient to be awake and interact with you. So technical issues like that are extremely limiting with regard to children and pediatrics for obvious reasons. The maturation of the skull the way the skull is fixed in the operating room for an adult can't be done with a child. So it requires a lot of variations, if you will, with regard to what we deal with on a daily basis with adult neurosurgery, and those have to be paid particular attention to, no question, but not too small, no.
Can you give me an example of in the area of brain tumors for you, you know, since you said most of them are serious, as the person helping the patient and the family, what's the most gratifying thing for you?
Well, there's many gratifying aspects to taking care of children with brain tumors, and the obvious is for that patient to come back years down the road, fully cured of their disease, and inviting you to their graduation from high school or their bar mitzvah or their whatever the case may be. It's just the celebration of life, and that is clearly the most rewarding aspect to that. On a daily basis, you get handwritten cards and photographs, and as individually they may sound very insignificant, but it makes the the toil and the amount of work and effort that goes into it, extremely, extremely rewarding. That is the obvious. Along the way, there are many, many gratifying parts of the job. Yeah, of course, I'm on some level a technician, and I love to operate, and I love to do meticulous surgery. So being able to accomplish your goal in a way that avoids any risk or morbidity of that child is extremely rewarding, no question about it. But being a contributor toward the well-being of that individual, and they have a normal life. Last week, I actually got an email from a patient that, regretfully, I didn't remember the name initially when I got the email, but this is an individual I operated on 9 years ago for a benign brain tumor, who was at a very high level in one of the real estate firms in New York City, who sent me an email introducing herself or reintroducing herself and stating that she is grateful every day of her life. And she sends me this email stating her position that she's currently in, which is a managerial position at a big, big firm in New York City. And that is a reward. That is extremely gratifying.
Hopefully she gave you an apartment.
No, I still have to pay.
Have you ever had the situation where a patient comes to you and said, I've gotten all these opinions in a brain tumor, and you know everyone says I'm inoperable, and you've dug deep into your soul and gone after it and done it, and the patient did well? Mm-hmm. Any experiences like that?
Yes, you have experiences like that, and a lot of interesting philosophical questions are raised in that, and that is, when you hear, and these are not neurosurgeons who aren't accomplished that might render an opinion like that. When you hear an opinion like that, it causes you to pause sometimes and think, well, is that true? And a very recent example I can think of is a child who actually came here from the Netherlands with a highly malignant and what most people would consider terminal disease. That's called trilateral retinoblastoma. Retinoblastoma itself is a cancer of the back of the eye. And sometimes that can spread to the brain. When they do spread to the brain, that's in a region that is very, very complicated to operate on, and most would expect that the morbidity is high. So they did search out another opinion, and when it was deemed inoperable in Europe, as well as a couple institutions in the United States, that was kind of the bill that was sent to us when the parents came here. I'm happy to say that child is now back in the Netherlands, normal, no tumor evidence that at all on their MRI scan or otherwise. And this is an example of the kind of the gratitude you get, and that is the child's father, who is an artist, sent me a rendering of their hometown on an oil-painted canvas, and extremely happy. And I get emails from them on a weekly basis with regard to their child. But yeah, that is not uncommon. That is not uncommon. And it's not a criticism toward any other neurosurgeon or anyone's abilities. It's more of the standpoint that I think that maybe in a humbled way I focus on certain diseases and expect that I am called upon to treat certain diseases that aren't on a routine basis dealt with by a lot of other neurosurgeons. So it's not infrequent. It really isn't.
Is there any particular emotion that you feel after you achieve something like that?
Lucky. but the emotion is, again, it goes back to what we were talking about before, and that is, again, if you can put yourself in the mindset of a parent who is being told that there's nothing else we can do, that the door is shut, that your child is not going to live beyond a certain age, and then to potentially reverse that emotional impact, that weight on their shoulders, boy, oh boy, I can't think of a more joyous contribution that you can give to that family, honestly.
How about how kids recover in distinction from adults? Is it faster? Is it the same rate?
Yeah. Jokingly or not, I always say that part of the reason I went into pediatric neurosurgery is because I don't have to deal with children who smoke and drink. And most of them don't. But they recover exceptionally well. The obvious systemic problems that adults may have, that's a given. The other issues is that the child's brain is extremely, extremely plastic, is what we call it, as far as its recoverable potential, and that certain parts of the brain can be injured, and these children can, with unbelievable resources, bounce back from injury. So it's always amazing to see these kids in the recovery room or the ICU on post-op day one, them giving you the thumbs-up sign or sitting up in their crib, and it's extremely, extremely rewarding. They have great potential for recovery, a lot more so than the adult population.
I'm sure that's reassuring to many of our parents listening out there. We have to take a brief break. Please stay with us, and we'll be back in one moment. welcome back to How to Save Your Life. Again, we're extremely pleased and honored to have as our guest Dr. Mark Swedan, an internationally acclaimed pediatric neurosurgeon from Weill Cornell Medical College. We were talking on the earlier part of the show about brain tumors in children. Mark, are there any new advances in pediatric neurosurgery that are affecting how you treat brain tumors?
Sure, no question. That's been a success story in evolution for decades. And there's a number of factors that have really contributed toward the better outcome in these children with brain tumors than we would have ever conceivably thought of when I was in training, for instance. And that ranges on the non-surgical side from different advances in chemotherapy, conformal means a highly focused form of radiation therapy. But within the surgical realm, some of the larger advances that we utilize really are focused on things such as minimally invasive or endoscopic techniques. What that means, and just to clarify what we typically do, to remove brain tumors, to treat certain forms of diseases, to gain access to those compartments of the brain, we need to make an incision in the scalp. A portion of the skull is actually removed, which is replaced later. At a later point in time during the procedure, and then either work through the brain or around surfaces of the brain to get to the brain tumor itself for resection or to treat fluid-filled chambers such as arachnoid cysts or congenital cysts. These have been impacted greatly with the use of minimally invasive technology. Minimally invasive technology we've kind of inherited from kind of the general things that you hear about all the time are laparoscopic work by the general surgeons. And endoscopy, what that means is small caliber endoscopes, which are basically nothing more than a rod of lens that transmits an image to a screen that we utilize in the operating room.
So it's like a miniature telescope.
Exactly right, yeah. And the beauty of that is those telescopes have now been reduced in size dramatically. So not only can the person who operates in the chest or the person who operates in the abdomen use these, but the neurosurgeon can use them because those have been reduced to a size that is on the order of about the tip of your pen that's sitting in front of you, and even smaller in some circumstances. And those endoscopes can be used with highly, highly advanced technology to do things such as treat water on the brain by way of making the fluid in the brain go to a different route, for instance. You know, I've really had quite an experience with endoscopy, and it really starts very, very early on with regard to things such as treating water on the brain or hydrocephalus, but that's now escalated into a realm where we're taking out brain tumors with an endoscope. And when I'm talking about the size of the endoscope for taking out brain tumors, again, it's on the order of less than a quarter inch. And to be able to do that in certain parts of the brain that are almost not accessible via the standard craniotomy or operations that we utilize is a gift. It really, really is. So those techniques have really impacted the treatment of children, not just with brain tumors, but other congenital disorders of the brain. And I can't think of any other technological advancement in the past 10 years that has truly impacted the well-being of kids other than minimally invasive technologies like endoscopy.
So, you know, when you say impacted, I mean, obviously you go in, you take the tumor out, mm-hmm. or you treat this water on the brain. What's the measurable impact? I mean, what does it mean to the child, and what do mom and dad really see? I mean,
the child
gets out of the hospital faster, and what does it mean?
Yeah, I mean, Phil, one thing we didn't talk about is, you know, impact to the child is not just measured by how well they do in school or mom and dad's assessment, but how the child reacts to this. And you take a 9-year-old girl who's going to go back to school with hair that's shaven, or there's a little imperfection in the skull from an operation she's had. This is a big, big bearing on impact. There's no question about it. That's on some level cosmetic. It's on some level psychosocial. But those are big, big issues for a child who's going to get returned back into a potentially very hostile environment with regard to school. I think it was 1997 I went to, and I was invited to a child's school here in New York after he underwent resection of a malignant brain tumor. And he did well, fortunately. And I went back to his school, and what was fascinating is the impression of his classmates of what he went through. So I took some surgical instruments and taught them about what surgery means. And there was a young girl in the second row or so, and I asked her if she understood what Nicholas had gone through. And she raised her hand and talked about you know, him being full of germs, you know, and being, in her estimation, I presume, contagious. So their perception is amazing. It really is. And they are insightful, and they will ask questions, but they have a gross misunderstanding of what that means. But another way of answering your question is, again, the potential neurologic compromise that somebody might undergo with larger operations, where you have to work around or through certain parts of the brain. If you can minimize that through these smaller techniques and minimally invasive techniques, much, much better for the patient.
One of the things you brought up at the early part of this conversation was radiation therapy and chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. Those also set up red flags in the eyes of people. How have those changed? We all know of the old days when children got whole brain radiation and they were devastated by mm-hmm. it. That's gotten better as well.
Yeah, it's gotten tremendously better. And we have, I guess so many stories in medicine are, I wouldn't say learned from our mistakes, but we learned from our past experience. I would not consider them mistakes. And as a great example of that, I'll focus on a cancer of the brain in children called medulloblastoma, which is a very common tumor that occurs in the brain. Historically, when we made a huge improvement in the survival rate of this disease, anywhere from children who had about a 30% expectation for survival after 5 years to now greater than 60 or 70%. When we became very, very inquisitive about the outcome of those children above and beyond just survival, it was pretty impressive as far as the number of those children that were in special educational classes and needed some type of assistance through their normal scholastic achievements and pursuits. So with that came the understanding that radiation in those doses that were curative were also harmful in a different domain, and that was cognitive and intellectual maturation. So that the radiation since that time has been changed tremendously on two large domains. One is the way to basically address the dose of radiation therapy, so dose reduction by reducing the overall energy of the radiation. And the other is by painting, if you will, and that's what it's called, using a computer algorithm to really confine the radiation to a very, very precise target, has spared a lot of the important portions of the brain that subserve things such as short-term memory or hearing and all these vital and basic functions that a child needs to integrate the environment around them and learn. And then the other major avenue with regard to the radiation therapy has been supplementing that with chemotherapy. So we've learned that you can reduce the overall dose and exposure to radiation by supplementing with very well-tolerated chemotherapy systemically through the bloodstream. And those two concepts, dose reduction with highly conformal fields or focused fields, and then supplementing with chemotherapy has, I wouldn't say avoided all of those risks, but dramatically reduced that risk with regard to cognitive function.
You use the term computerized algorithm. I presume you're talking about modeling. And you know, how do you think computers have affected the way neurosurgeons work? Is it the you know the 21st century invention that's really improved our outcomes?
Yeah, I was with a group of medical students literally 2 days ago, and we were talking about some aspect of the history of neurosurgery and how one approaches deep-seated tumors and how we've really become spoiled by technology. And technology has positively impacted our profession tremendously. Tumor localization, finding a tumor that can be pea-sized, you know, 6 centimeters or 3.5 inches down from the surface of the brain, was exploratory previously. Yeah, the ability that we can now see these things in three dimensions, model these before we get to the time of surgery. We can actually do mock surgeries and do dissections on the computer generated images that we're looking at, and then take those images in the operating room. So it's not just confined to radiation therapy, but in the surgical arena, the computers have impacted what we do tremendously. And those days of exploratory surgery and being 20 minutes into an operation, say, is the tumor here? Am I going to find this tumor? I don't think I could have gone into neurosurgery if I had to live through that type of experience. And I pay a lot of credit to our predecessors, but the computer has really impacted our ability to do this in a positive way.
Lately in the newspaper, there's been a lot of information and a number of operations on conjoined twins or children that are joined at some part of their body. What's your sense of this? It seems to be a rash of it going on. Is there a sudden interest? Do we think that the surgical technology has improved to the point, or what's going on?
I think there's several things that are going on. I don't think the incidence has changed at all. Maybe the potential survival of these individuals, which is a complex embryologic problem, developmental problem, has improved. So maybe there are more individuals, children or adults, with these types of processes, whether they're joined at the head or other parts of the body. But I think that the interest, the social interest, is just profound today for a number of reasons, some of which I can't explain and some of which I probably could. But I think to pay respect in the way our world has evolved with regard to giving medical care to those that might not be able to afford it or have access to certain very, very complicated forms of surgery has raised our level of awareness that individuals maybe from other countries that might not have that access come to this country for these type of very, very complicated processes. The other has been, we were talking about technology and how that's impacted outcome of patients. Many of these diseases were considered, or this specific disease, conjoined twins or Siamese twins, to use the common terminology, was a fatal attempt at surgical separation previously. So it has improved dramatically with regard to the survival capacity of those patients. But it makes for great, great media attention. There's no question about it. And that's notwithstanding the ethical issues, especially when we deal with individuals who are actually, as we've recently seen, two practicing attorneys who are joined at the head. What do you do with this, knowing that the potential risk to one of those or both of those is large? So I think it's a complicated issue from the standpoint of why there's so much interest. But, we've made great strides and improvements, and I think it's a compliment to the way we've dealt with individuals that come seeking very complicated forms of surgery. But it's interesting to me in the sense that on a daily basis we see children who have traumatic brain injury. Someone falls off their bike and ends up with a blood clot that in 20 minutes we can evacuate and restore that person back to normalcy. And that's never on the radar screen as far as the impact that has as with regard to the appreciation by society, if you will. For the parents, yes, but it's not interesting. And I find that fascinating and very disproportionate.
Let's shift gears, or maybe not even that much, doing something like Siamese twins, but also in pediatrics, a lot of what you do involves a large team of doctors. And I'm thinking of the craniofacial work, the spasticity, and kids being in neonatal ICUs, large teams of doctors. And the first question I want to ask in that regard is, how do you help the family? I mean, how do you avoid the confusion that can happen with multiple doctors coming in and rendering opinions keep the patient's family happy? I mean, obviously the children usually can't comprehend what's going on.
Sure, that's easy. Give them my cell phone number. and I forewarn them because you're right. It takes a huge, huge team. It takes a huge team of specialists that have trained for the same number of years as I have for their noted subspecialty, anesthesia, you mentioned intensive care units, neurologists, epileptologists, endocrinologists, ophthalmologists. I mean, it's just so profound as far as the number of individuals that are really there to make that kid better and give them every chance they got to have a normal life. So that they are, as I usually describe to the parents, there are certain stages of a process. And during the perioperative stage, before and after the operation, I will play that quarterback. And they have ready access to me 24 hours a day because they will have questions. They will get frustrated. They will hear something different from even my residents versus someone else. And in an academic institution, as you're very well aware of, there are a great number of individuals above and beyond that quarterback, if you will. So the best way to avoid confusion is to really have that one-on-one conversation with them. I am going to be that child's advocate. Here is my cell phone number, my pager number. Do not get into a situation where you're confused, worried, concerned about something. You call me and we'll deal with that at that point in time. Because it can get overwhelming to them and they can get extremely confused with information that might get filtered to them via many mechanisms. It's a very insightful question and it's a problematic issue that I think a lot of people outside of pediatrics don't get exposed to. You're right.
Well, let's take it down one road of the craniofacial, which is children with funny-shaped heads. Mm-hmm. You've got geneticists and ophthalmologists or eye doctors, aside from the neurosurgeons and plastic surgeons. And often, the parents come in thinking, gosh, we did something wrong. Mm. Take us through that process. I mean, how common are these funny-shaped head disorders? And if a parent suspects that it's a funny-shaped head, where should they go?
Yeah. The team approach that you mentioned before is so important in a disease such as craniofacial disorders, because someone who may view these children views them from the standpoint of what they look like. That is, more times than not, the tip of the iceberg. And that can involve so many different parts of the, not just the skull, the brain, the palate and the facial skeleton, the way the eyes work, the hearing, and then systemic issues, with regard to the spine, the long bones, even basic functions such as respiratory and renal function. So where they need to go is so important that they go to a place where this is all consolidated in one entity. I'm proud to say that when we work on craniofacial children or evaluate craniofacial children or children with these types of disorders, ranging from the most simplistic to the most complex, they come in one half of a day, they see every one of these individuals that is necessary for them to be evaluated by. That is the geneticist, that is the ophthalmologist, the oral surgeon, the neurosurgeon, the plastic surgeon. And it's all coordinated by an individual who basically spearheads that type of initiative. And it's so obvious, the disparity, when somebody may come to my office, newly diagnosed with regard to one of these malformations, and I see that child and I start listing the number of people that parents want to see, and they start pulling out their hair and they're overwhelmed and they have six different phone numbers and it's going to take them 3 months to see all these specialists. So a craniofacial clinic and team is really one example of where that's a huge, huge resource for the parent. So I would advise a parent that has a question or a known diagnosis of a craniofacial disorder, craniosynostosis, to be evaluated at a place that has a dedicated craniofacial clinic and team. Extremely, extremely important.
Yeah, as we were talking about craniofacial, I was thinking about the movie Mask with Cher, and that was an extreme example of a craniofacial deformity. What do you think is harder, the surgery or the psychosocial component associated with the disease?
Yeah, they're both hard, but for different individuals. The surgery is extremely challenging. The psychosocial issue for the patient and the family, I don't think we can imagine. But it's always struck me as insightful and rewarding how, how well a child and the parents overcome certain societal biases against certain things, such as cosmesis. It's very rewarding to see how a child matures rapidly and learns that it's not the most important aspect of who they are and what they can do. It's really rewarding.
It's interesting that in medicine we marvel at people's ability to adapt like this, but then we open the newspaper and it's always filled with the prettiest face and the best physique and the latest designs.
That's why I don't read the newspapers anymore.
We have to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment to How to Save Your Life with Dr. Mark Swedan. Stay tuned. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and my guest this evening is Dr. Mark Swedan, an internationally acclaimed pediatric neurosurgeon in the New York area. Mark, we've spent a lot of time talking about patients and families and other people. You know, it seems to me that what you do on a day-to-day basis is hard, coping with the ups and downs of diseases that affect children, and specifically diseases of the central nervous system. I mean, how did you get into medicine in the first place?
I got into medicine because I was blessed in that I had the parental support and really guidance to do what I wanted to do. And it's always been an interest of mine with regard to natural sciences and anatomy. And fortunately, I came from a family where my parents, who truly both of them weren't educated, they valued the concept of education. Immigrants of this country from Lebanon as 20 and 22-year-olds. You know, dad working on the assembly line in Ford Motor Company and raising six children with my mother. Instilling nothing as far as values more important than very, very basic principles, integrity, honesty, but above all, achieving an education. These are parents who saw the worst of the worst, and when they came to this country, they truly had a vision that was the immigrant vision that comes to this country and it offers them the potential to have a better life. And they saw education as the key to that, fortunately. So really that path was wide open regardless of what pursuit I or any of my brothers and sisters wanted to pursue. And that was just you do the best job you can in that pursuit of education and the rest will pay off. And they were extremely right, no question about it. You know, I've learned so many things, not just from my father and my mother, but you know, growing up in Detroit was interesting in that his experience at Ford Motor Company. I worked at a brass factory for most of my high school, a place called Anaconda Brass and Steel, which no longer exists, as most heavy industry in places like Detroit and Pittsburgh don't. But it was impressive to me how these individuals who had worked there their whole lives worked for one motivation, and that was so their children wouldn't have to do the same thing they were doing. And they valued the dollar, they valued hard work, and boy, were they hard workers. And to know that they sacrificed everything, including their own happiness, the type of job they had, which was very, very difficult work, so that their children would not have the same type of life that they had, was extremely, extremely rewarding and insightful. And that taught me an awful lot.
Do you think any of those experiences had an impact on why you chose a pediatric area to go into?
I don't think that had any impact on why I went into pediatrics.
So what happened there? Was there a mentor?
Several mentors along the way, but I'll be honest with you. Part of it was by accident, and that was during medical school, which I always knew I wanted to go to medical school. There's no question about it. I had an interest in embryology and the formation of the human body, and my initial want and desire was to go into pediatric cardiothoracic surgery. I was very fascinated by the workings of the heart and the malformations of the heart that would exist and how one chamber might not be right and how you can repair this surgically. So I spent between my second and third year trying to pursue a second-year medical student has no role in that in that aspect of clinical medicine, but shadowing a pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon at Children's Hospital in Michigan. And he also advised that I speak to a pediatric neurosurgeon by the name of Arthur Eisenbray, who has since passed away, who was an extremely valuable mentor. And I spent the summer with him, and I was fascinated. And there was truly nothing else I wanted to do after that summer. And this is before I even learned how to draw blood. You know, I was circulating and going through the wards with this individual, and boy, I was overly fascinated by what was going on and the different disease processes. It was absolutely wonderful. And a mentor in many, many different respects. He was an extremely, extremely good doctor. He was well, well loved by his patients, by everybody he worked with. Accomplished pianist, marriage that lasted forever, and just a worldly individual that had such compassion and dedication to his job. That's what I wanted to be like. And he was a great mentor, and fortunately, I saw him early on in my career and got exposed to him early on in my career. The truth of the matter is, as a second-year medical student, it could have been a pathologist, and I probably would have been equally enlightened, I would expect. Yeah. But
so serendipity brought you to pediatric neurosurgery. What keeps you going? I mean, these are, you know, as we've been talking over the past, 40 minutes, yeah. Some of these things are devastating. What gets you up in the morning?
Yeah, wow. NPR, which is true. But I usually wake up before the alarm goes off almost invariably. But the thing that gets me up in the morning, the thing that really, really drives me now is I love my job more and more every day. I think more of my personality gets colored into what I do on a daily basis. The fact that I can be around children every day and kind of relish in their naivete and their courage and really their innocence is just wonderful. It really is. But really what motivates me, it's not just getting me up in the morning, because I have to get up in the morning, but what keeps me here at night and on weekends is the want to make this better. You watch a child succumb to a disease that you in your heart of hearts believe doesn't have to happen because of a limitation of knowledge, because of a limitation of technology. And boy, nothing is more motivating than to keep you here more hours than you normally would spend. And, you know, you get exposed, Phil, to, you can go to the greatest opera, read the most fantastic, emotionally charged novel, fall short of what you see on a daily basis. Just last week, I was taking a child to the operating room for yet another operation for a brain tumor. I think it's this child's third operation. He knows me, he's 6 years of age, and he recognizes who I am and what I represent. And he's extremely, extremely mature in his approach toward this. And as we were getting ready to take him to the operating room, and we allow the parents to kind of go with the child in the operating room, and they get mild sedation at that point in time. And as he starts to doze off, he looks up at his mom and he reaches up her and he says, "Mommy, please hold me." You see this and you witness this. And again, the emotional and the human aspect that goes into this is nothing that you can come close to representing in any other art form or modality in life. I really believe that the child and its parent is amazing as far as that emotional impact. And that's both motivational from the standpoint of wanting to improve things and wanting to do a better job, to just wanting exposure of it. And it works at both extremes of that emotional roller coaster.
You said earlier, or referred earlier, to the fact that you teach medical students. And you know, what kind of lessons, other than the technical things that you have to teach them, what kind of lessons you try to pass on to them?
I don't think it's anything I'm cognizant of. I really don't. I was having lunch today between operative cases, and I happened to sit down at a table in the medical school with an individual that I first met when he was a second-year medical student, and is now a third-year resident in actual radiology. And he wants to go into neuroradiology, and he's fascinated by the brain. And in speaking with him, it didn't even occur to me that I had an impact on his career choice. So I think it's something that's not always tangible. And then the things he commented on, he's never told me this before. This was 6 years ago. He said just your dedication to the field, the way you interact with your patients, really your passion for what you do is what brought me to that field and really sparked my interest. So, yeah, you can teach someone the technical aspects of a difficult surgical procedure. You can guide them to the greatest textbook that deals with anatomy of the brain, and all those things are valid. And I think similar for me, when I was young and going through the educational aspect of this, it's the mentorship as far as how one conducts themselves with regard to motivation and dedication to their field.
So where's the research going to go? I mean, you know, we're teaching young, good medical students, but is there anything new on the horizon in the pediatric world that everybody should start looking for in the New York Times?
Oh, boy. hopefully in the neuroscience literature before the New York Times. But yeah, there are some fantastic things happening in the realm of research for pediatric neurosurgery. And wow, you mentioned or you asked earlier what it is that keeps me here. Namely, my place of employment beyond the hours that might be required. It's research. And research unquestionably is the only mechanism that we're going to experience that gets us to the next step. And that research is usually something that is born out of, and certainly in my experience, I didn't come here as a researcher, I came here as a clinician, but was born out of the frustration of what I see on a daily basis. Again, watching I remember, you know, Matthew, well, avoid the use of the last name, but who died of a brain tumor in 1996, a year after I started my staff position here, frustrated me beyond all belief. I remember sitting down a couple weeks later with an oncologist strategizing as far as if we had to tackle one disease in pediatric neurosurgery, what could that possibly be? And What is there no alternative for? So to guide your research out of a frustrating aspect of clinical medicine is fantastic because it's goal-directed, it's tangible, and it's hopefully something that is very translatable into clinical improvement. And out of that came a commitment from myself, and it's still ongoing today, where my lab grows on a yearly basis to work toward improving the outcome of children with brain tumors. And not to get too technical, but we've been focusing on things such as, which is a very important part of treatment of a lot of neurological disorders, not just brain tumors today, and that's being able to deliver a certain therapeutic molecule directly into the site of interest for the brain. That can be anything from a movement disorder to a brain tumor to a degenerative process. But being able to bypass a huge limitation of getting therapy to the brain, and that was through the bloodstream or taking something orally, which doesn't usually reach the tissue of the brain or the tissues that we're interested in, by bypassing all that, by using very, very small microscopic catheters to get into the site of interest where you can now deliver these molecules, which opens up great, great avenues, especially today with all the research that's going into molecular biology and the structure of the way cancer works and other diseases of the brain. So large molecules that we could never get to the brain before, we're bypassing that with these types of technologies. And that's what my laboratory is focused on, and it's an area of research and really all of neurosciences that is very exciting.
Do you envision the day where all of neurosurgery will be done through a hole no larger than a dime?
All no. Some of what we do today, yes. You know, it's, fortunately for us and for neurosurgeons and the people we're training, it will never be so simplistic to think that it'll all be done through a hole the size of a dime. People will, and children will continue to fall off their bikes. Diseases will continue to progress such that we don't get recognition of them early on. So the skills that we acquire from the standpoint of understanding the anatomy of the brain and surgical skills won't ever be lost, and there will always be a need for it, no question about it. But unquestionably, that the concept of minimally invasive technology and things such as deep brain stimulation and local therapy are going to be, and they are on the horizon, and not just on the horizon, but in practice today. And those will become part and parcel of what our residents today are learning. It'll be very important as far as their armamentarium, as far as what they take into the operating room.
I'm glad you brought up bicycle accidents. We're kind of getting into the football season. Our children are running off and playing both football and soccer. What warnings do you have for both the kids and mom and dad about, you know, how to avoid severe head and neck injuries?
Yeah, you'll never avoid them entirely. You know, kids are kids. You know, they should be allowed to play soccer and football and all the things that we did as children, and that's what makes a child a child. You know, there will be no way to protect a child unequivocally against injury, head injury. With that being said, it's a total waste and shame that the number of children that we see that continue to be admitted to the ICU with head injury, who can and might have been prevented from very, very simple techniques. The number of individuals that are still unrestrained in automobile accidents today, the children that are not appropriately placed in car seats, children who are playing full contact sports without appropriate and certified headgear, for instance, protective headgear. So these save lives, these motivations and these things that have now been instituted and overseen by most organized athletic endeavors, they save lives. There's no question about it. But it still fascinates me. And I was flying back from a meeting not too long ago. I won't mention the air carrier, but there was a thing on X sports or extreme sports about these kids on skateboards going through these half tubes or half pipes, I think they call them, and doing all kinds of amazing acrobatics. Delightful to watch, but kids without helmets. Yeah. And I'm shocked by this, and I'm shocked that it still goes on today.
So do you think bicycle helmets are great? Helmets should be worn during skiing, obviously for skateboarding. All those kinds of precautions should be taken.
As we're entering the winter season, snowboarding, skiing, yeah, no question about it, yeah.
What about concussions in kids? You know, is it more significant in a child than it is in an adult? Are there any different implications in terms of their performance in school?
Well, you know, concussions, a single concussive episode, probably not. You know, kids are blessed. We spoke about the recovery of the brain and the plasticity. Kids are also blessed in that they don't have as much room inside their head when they take a fall, for instance. Adults are more prone to certain types of hemorrhage with regard to things like concussive episodes. But at the same time, when a child is involved in a organized athletic activity, whether it be boxing or football, where a concussion has happened, probably high time to start thinking seriously about whether or not that's the best thing that the child should be doing on a repetitive basis. So repetitive injury and repetitive concussive episodes, no question, might have a bearing on the potential for that child to gain the normal cognitive function that all of us have the potential to do. So a single episode, probably not. But it's probably a warning sign that maybe it's time to think about a different endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Child has a mild concussion, brief mm-hmm. loss of consciousness, playing football. Parents bring him in. What do you tell them? Can they go back to football that season?
Depends if the child asks or the parents ask. Who I want to befriend at that point in time. Yeah. Listen, I don't have a child who wants to play football at this point in time, but it would be hard to tell them no. You know, it really would. But by most accounts, I think that those injuries are rare. And I think for the number of kids that are playing full contact sports, fortunately, we see very, very few injuries from those. So I leave it up to the parents and in their discussions with the children if they're old enough. I have a bias against going back to play sports like that, full contact sports, once an injury of that magnitude has occurred. But by and large, it's something that I leave up to the parents to decide.
You've been listening to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and it's been my distinct honor and pleasure to have Dr. Mark Swedan as our guest. Dr. Swedan is an internationally acclaimed pediatric neurosurgeon. He's the vice chairman and professor of neurological surgery at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Dr. Swedan, thank you for visiting with us.
And thank you, Phil, for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ken Ipp is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Shartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.